everybody, I'm Kai Rizal. Welcome to Make Me Smart. Welcome back, I hope. I hope you're not a first-time visitor. But if you are, welcome.
If you are, we are delighted that you decided to join us
Where
on the
been?
Show. I'm Molly Wood.
Where you been?
Welcome, no matter who you are. On this show, we try to talk about the big issues in tech, the economy, and culture, and we do all of that with your help, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
That actually happens to be especially true this time, because it literally was inspired by y'all. A couple of months back, we talked to a woman by the name of Morgan Mercer. She runs a startup that uses virtual reality, VR, in sexual harassment training and education programs. And that episode that we ran, which was totally fascinating, actually, prompted this question from Jamie Bond.
If virtual reality immersion is truly so powerful that it can be triggering to sexual abuse survivors and healing for companies ripe with sexually harassing cultures, then how long before virtual reality technology is leveraged by marketers and political opportunists to psychologically rob us of our free will?
Well, happy Tuesday, everybody, first of all.
Welcome to the show.
Glad you could be here. But we set out to try to answer that question.
Yep. Yeah, because it is remarkable. And in fact, there are experts studying this exact thing. We spoke to a guy who runs the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford. I have a little experience with the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford, which is where I went to learn about virtual reality and empathy, and also had to virtually jump into a big hole in the ground. It was, it was like, to this day,
terrible.
One of the scariest experiences ever. You put on the goggles and you walk out onto this plank, and then they say, you know, it's virtual reality, and you know that. It's like a test of how immersed your mind gets, how quickly. And he said, you got to just step off this plank. Like, intellectually,
No, you don't.
I know. And I was like, I don't want to jump off the plank, but I did it. And then guess what they did? Spoiler alert.
Wow.
They make it seem like you're falling into a hole, and then you panic and scream and run away. And then your camera person really laughs. Anyway. Other than that, Jeremy Bilinson is a perfectly nice person. He runs this lab at Stanford and teaches communications. And so we started off by asking him about his biggest concerns about virtual reality.
So number one, the thing that I worry about the most is distraction. And if you think about media in general, media are distracting. On Stanford's campus, I like to joke that undergrads, their legs don't move unless their thumbs are moving. They can't really walk unless they're texting, right? And virtual reality is arguably the most distracting medium in history. By definition, we have this word presence, which means in VR, you are completely in the simulation. Molly, we were talking earlier about when she was trying to walk this virtual plank, it felt real to her. Yeah. Part of that is that you're blocking out the physical world. And so the things that I talk about a lot with decision makers at companies are, how can we make it so that people aren't so distracted that they're walking into traffic, they're getting mugged in the subway? So our listeners may have read about this, but we had the first death that I know of in the history of virtual reality in December 2017. A man in Moscow was playing a video game and fell through a plate glass table and bled to death. And so because VR is so distracting, we need to think about how to stop tragic events like that. And now on the counter to that, there are conservatively right now, you know, 10 million systems in the United States, if you count the high-end systems that let you walk around and use your hands. And if you count, you know, just head turning, these are your phone-based systems, probably about 20 million in the United States. And we haven't seen many events like that in the United States. So it's tragic about this Russian man, but at least we haven't seen that type of scale and that type of distraction injuries happening here.
But it gets, we should say, way darker than just distraction, right? There's the potential, as our listener raised, of brainwashing, of torture, of surveillance.
Well, first of all, I don't want to diminish distraction, because we can talk about those things that are kind of sexy to talk about. But in the United States, conservatively, 9 people a day are killed by distracted drivers using their phones every single day. Now, fast forward to VR. You may think that nobody would drive a car while they have virtual reality goggles on, right? That would be insane. But we have a data point on this. It's a video game called Pokemon Go, which is an augmented reality game where you're looking through your phone or looking through a tablet, and it's a real-time video where you're overlaying these characters that you're trying to capture.
I believe Ms. Wood is familiar with that game.
No comment. No comment.
Molly, you haven't driven while playing,
Pokemon
have you?
While driving.
All right.
Okay. But there's a number of documented cases of car accidents occurring because people were playing this game. And I truly believe that with VR, you know, people will do it. So when I go to talk to these big tech companies, I beg them. I stand on a stage and I've got the C-suite in the room and I say, please, can you make it, forget software, from a hardware standpoint, that VR will never work in a moving car? And they'll say, well, what about the passengers? And what about a driverless car? And I say, you know what? That's fine. Please, let's nip this in the bud right now. And so that's one of the pleas that I make. And Molly, you know, we could talk about these more esoteric ones, and I'm happy to talk about the data that I know. But if, you know, we have to go in order, and in order, the thing that concerns me are people being so distracted that it changes how the physical world works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder how much of this is going to become a design versus use question, because people are going to do what they're going to, you know, we're having this conversation right now about other kinds of technology. Is it designed too much to addict us, to engage us, I guess might be a better way to put it. And this is, of course, the next level of engagement. Like you said, is there a, should the manufacturers be required to make it not work in the car or turn it off after 30 minutes?
Which gets to the regulatory question too. Sorry to pile in, but those are of a piece, right?
Let me say very clearly to our listeners, because I tend to get lots of angry mail from people, I am not a fan of regulation. I am not trying to regulate content. The U.S. Supreme Court in 2011 ruled that violent video game content and all video game content is protected because it's art, and I am not advocating for regulation. So what I want to do is I want to circle back to the question, but I want to talk about privacy and how I'm attempting to think about this. Is that okay to shift to the privacy discussion?
No, totally.
Yeah, definitely.
So the narrative here involves nonverbal behavior. And we know from a number of pioneering psychologists, you know, the name that comes to mind most readily is Paul Ekman, that, you know, you can regulate what you say. You know, I've practiced my words to try to be witty today in this radio show. You know, consider the things you post on social media, but you can't control your facial tics, your genuine smiles. It's called a Duchenne smile, about how your eyes move. You can't control these sidelong glances when you're nervous. And there's much research in psychology that shows you can learn a lot about a person when you look at their nonverbal behavior. It tells you their intentions, their personality, you know, if they're lying or not. And there's a ton of research there. Now, but here's the rake. Virtual reality only works because you're tracking somebody's physical movement. And this is a critical point for the listeners to follow here, that in VR, when somebody wants to get closer to an object, they literally walk in the physical space towards it, and that body movement is tracked. When they want to look at something, they rotate their head to the left. So in other words, nonverbal behavior is tracked in order necessarily to make VR work. VR doesn't work unless you're tracking that body language. Now, most commercial systems track 18 different movements, 6 on your head and 6 on each hand, and they track them at least 90 times a second. So if you do the math here, if I'm in VR for 20 minutes, you are recording just under 2 million data points about my body language, and that's just 20 minutes.
Wow.
This is wholly unprecedented in the history of nonverbal behavior. It's a massive, massive pile of data. And what we've done is, in my lab for the past 12 years, we have used sometimes machine learning, big data analysis, and sometimes you don't even need machine learning to ask the question, what can you learn about somebody from their body language that the VR systems automatically track? When you train the system, you collect a lot of data about what people are doing with their body, and then also what their mental state is or how they're performing. Can you build models that will predict someone's behavior based on how they're moving their bodies?
Wow.
That's mildly terrifying.
So that seems like next level data collection, right? Like there should probably be rules about that immediately.
So there's good and bad here. So let me give you an example of a good case. And so we've done work. Andrea Stevenson-Wan, she's now a professor at Cornell, did amazing work in our lab. She used the Microsoft Kinect, which is a, you know, a VR capture device that tracks your body movements. And she had a teacher and a learner, and the Microsoft Kinect was tracked on both their bodies while the teacher was instructing the learner. In other words, there's a teacher and a student, and we're tracking their nonverbal behavior during a lesson. Then we give the student a test, the learner does a test, and we can, you know, give, you know, we categorize the learner into high and low on the test score. We then use machine learning to take as input the body language during the lesson, and we use it to predict if that person was going to do well on the test. In other words, we ask the question, can you predict someone's test score from the way their body moved while they were learning? Oh. And the answer is a strong yes, with 86% accuracy. The body language of the learner and the teacher, when you combine them, predicts how someone's going to perform on a test.
That's incredibly cool. Completely weirding me out, though, I have to say, because I'm a scutcher when I learn and I'm sitting in class, and that kind of freaks me out. But me aside, so in our best, most enlightened VR future, 10 years from now, what does it look like?
Class is going to change based on your nonverbals. If you're not understanding things, things are going to slow down. If you are understanding things, the lesson's going to get harder. We've done some specific research on what's called stereotype threat. For example, women who are learning science or math, when they're reminded of the stereotype that women aren't supposed to be as good at math or science, being reminded about that causes them to actually do worse. This is Claude Steele's famous work. It's called stereotype threat. And in VR, there's ways that you can change that. You can repopulate the room. You can strip gender away from avatars so that you can't even tell the gender. And there's all sorts of really neat programming tools you can use to actually make students have a better learning environment.
I assume that the less pro-social applications, I mean, you could see this also applying in courtrooms or to advertising or maybe on the plus side to evaluate a future date. But like doctors using it to determine if you're ill for insurance purposes, you know, you could imagine this extending in lots of ways.
We just published an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and this was about, among other things, what can you learn about someone clinically from their body language? And really early research by Skip Rizzo shows that, you know, when you look at someone's head movements as they're in a virtual classroom, you can really quickly differentiate those that have been diagnosed with ADHD compared to those that have not been diagnosed. So really quick ways you can pick up things like ADHD. A study that Peter Mundy and colleagues published at UC Davis shows that you can detect children who have been diagnosed with autism based on the eye contact patterns they exhibit in the virtual world. It's pretty easy to figure out a lot of clinical categories based on how somebody's moving.
Wow. I mean, where does it go, I guess? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So where does it go and how do we solve this? And so this gets back to, you know, so I've read all of the privacy policies of the big tech companies, that both hardware and software, in terms of what they're thinking about. And the truth is, right now, I don't think you've seen much, you know, action and deliberation about this nonverbal privacy issue. But the good news is in early November, Philip Rosedale, who you may remember Second Life, he was the CEO and founder of Second Life. He's got a new company called High Fidelity. He and I are hosting a conference here at Stanford that is all about how do we solve this privacy issue in VR. And we've gotten commitments from about half of the big tech VR companies to be there. And I believe that it's in the company's best interest to self-regulate here and to solve this privacy issue as a group. And so what we're going to try to do at this summit is to, you know, imagine a world in which the companies decide they are not going to record your tracking data. And so there is a model where we just don't record the data. And, you know, that doesn't solve the problem, but it's at least a good start.
You know, we didn't ask, which I didn't realize until just now, is how do we get past the adoption problem of people feeling weird sitting there with these things on their heads? Right?
Because we dove right into the horribility.
That's right. We went straight to the bad.
Which is a bummer, too. And Jeremy Bilinson himself said to us, like, I'm kind of crushed that when I finally get to come on the show, it's to talk about, you know, the bad stuff, because, like I said, the beginning of his research, a lot of his research was really truly around early on how to use virtual reality for empathy, for the kinds of training that we talked about, and how it can be sort of a force for good. So it's, you know, as with all things, particularly in tech, there's a balance there that has to be explored. But I do want to shout out to the good work that he's done. The positive too, but he has written a book this year called Experience on Demand: What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do.
And you don't have to jump into a big black hole. You can just buy that book and, you know, take it from there.
I mean,
speaking of books, next week, by the way, we're going to do lots and lots of bookish stuff and history stuff and all kinds of cool stuff. The Librarian of Congress, Dr. Carla Hayden, is going to be here to talk about her job, which is cool. And we want you to be a part of it. And the way to do it is this. You go to the Library of Congress website, loc.gov. Dig around. Lots of cool links, collections of letters and artifacts and all that jazz. Find something that you think is really cool that appeals to you. It's at loc.gov.
There's jazz also. There's literally jazz. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Just saying. They've got all these historical recordings and photo collections. It's actually pretty remarkable. It's a good rabbit hole to go down. We will feature your favorite things on the show, which makes me feel just a little bit Oprah. Favorite
really?
Things.
Really?
L-O-C. Yeah, Oprah? She's got the, isn't that the favorite things thing?
Know.
I'm pretty sure that's
know.
Oprah. Okay. Way to pretend like you don't know, Kai. That is L-O-C. He didn't used to call it avocado toast either. I'm just saying.
That's true.
L-O-C.gov.
I didn't know.
Send us an email or a voice memo or a screenshot of your favorite thing that you found there. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. We will all share our favorite stuff here on the podcast. Is it favorite things? It's one of those. I'm about to Google it during this break.
I kind of thought I invented avocado toast. It's true. Anyway, we got a break.
Amazing.
Go.
Welcome back.
I do love that little sting.
I love it. Time for some fixating, shall we?
We're a very heavy baseline themed sting program here, I'm just realizing.
We are kind of. We're made for Beats headphones.
Yes.
That's our preferred.
All right. So I got mine. You have yours. Oh, look, you have like five. What a surprise.
I do. I do.
Okay. Pick one.
I couldn't help it.
Pick one.
They're going to go fast. I'm not picking one.
You doing them all?
Yeah. It's going to go fast.
Whatever happened to the meeting where we said, okay, everybody pick one. And by everybody, they
I
mean both
it.
Of us.
You Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Okay. I tried, but I was obviously a failure.
All right. All right. Well, you're
right,
too curious
ready?
About too many things. Go.
That is exactly the problem.
Yes.
Okay. First, the ACLU has filed a lawsuit against Facebook over apparently potential employers excluding women from being able to see ads for their jobs.
What is the matter with people?
God. I mean, right? I had this really interesting conversation today with a friend about how Facebook is kind of like, you know how like when somebody gets drunk, it just amplifies their personality for good or ill.
Yeah.
I feel like in a way, not to let Facebook completely off the hook, but that's what Facebook does. Like it just amplifies
yep.
the terribleness that is humans. So they're now being sued for that. They've also faced obviously accusations of housing discrimination in the past too, because of this targeting, which literally says like, yeah, just uncheck the lady box and then you're good to go. And I may or may not have pre-ordered. I did. the forthcoming book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger.
Oh, is this
by Rebecca
Traister? Traister, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
who
she's
I may
great.
Or may
she,
not
yeah.
also want to have on. Yeah, she's,
yeah. yeah.
This
she's,
book is going to be, really I read good. I spent way too many minutes reading an excerpt from this book yesterday, and I was like, I might be a little pissed off.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Let's see, Tesla is also in trouble. They are facing criminal probes over the statement.
Funding secured.
We're go private. Funding secured. And the Thai cave diver sued Elon Musk personally for defamation.
Okay, so can I turn you to a serious thought here? Honest to God, how long does he have his job at Tesla?
I don't know. I really don't. I mean, I have to assume that because the board isn't going to turn on him, right? The board is like his brother.
Yeah, it's like, literally like his brother or his cousin or something, whoever it is. Kimball,
his actual brother, yeah, Kimball is on the board and everybody else is kind of handpicked and he's the chairman.
But it's
and
a publicly
CEO.
Traded freaking company, right?
Turns out there may be some loopholes there that we didn't see coming.
All right.
But I think the one thing, it's possible that, and this is my real fixation, is this week in San Francisco, and I didn't get to go, but there was this big Ballyhooed reveal of the Audi e-tron. They are now, they've created basically, it's an Audi electric SUV.
Oh.
So like the competition is coming for Tesla. You know, Volkswagen announced it's not going to sell the Beetle anymore. It's going to start focusing on electric vehicles. And the concepts for those look super cool. It's possible that Tesla's lasting legacy might just be spurring
right.
real competition right. in electric vehicles. And maybe that would be, it wouldn't be enough for Elon, but it would be enough for me.
Well, and the planet, right? I mean, that's legit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty, so, you know, yeah. and that competition is now officially arriving. Yeah. And the e-trons look pretty awesome. And then halla freaking Luya.
What?
Twitter surprised us all today with a new ability to just make the timeline show up in reverse chronological order. No algorithm, no maybe you missed it. None
while
of that.
You were away.
Just like while you were away, maybe just like what happened in the last half hour, which is great when you're actually trying to use Twitter for news, and
right.
I'm stoked.
Right.
And that is all.
There you go. All right, my turn.
Yes, finally.
Okay, finally, for crying out loud, I've only got one.
Do as much as you want.
Because, wait, oh, those were the rules. You know me, I'm a law-abiding citizen. Mine is, not too surprisingly, about the trade war, which is now at another level with the president's tariffs earlier this week on another $200 billion worth of Chinese imports, taking it to about half of what we buy from China. But what I want to do is I want to play a piece of tape from the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, on CNBC this morning, Tuesday morning, talking about sort of a big picture-y kind of thing. And then, actually, I'm going to agree with the Secretary of Commerce. Let me just heads up here. He's a slow talker. So it's a 25-second cut, but it feels like a longer time. Here he is.
Okay. Well, you can do the numbers this way. If you have a 10% tariff on another $200 billion, that's $20 billion a year. That's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of 1% total inflation in the U.S. Because it's spread over thousands and thousands of products, nobody's going to actually notice it at the end of the day.
So, he's right. It is a tiny, tiny fraction of inflation and of this economy and all of those things. And it's about, at 10%, it's about $127 per family per year, right? Which is not a huge deal for most families. That said, for some families, it is a big deal. So he does have a point. I just want to stress, though, that the part of this trade war thing that's maybe not everybody's counting or paying attention to is that there ain't no sign of backing down. And the president said earlier this week, we're going to start tariffs of 10% this coming Monday. That'll be the 24th of September. And then if there's not a deal with the Chinese by the 1st of January, they're going up to 25%. So I would just caution those of you who think it might not be a big deal yet, Mr. Secretary, that there are other things coming down the pike. And that's it. That's it. So he's right a little bit and wrong a little bit.
Well, he's right today.
Today, yes.
But he may be wrong by January.
That's true.
And yeah,
that is true. And I was right. He's a slow talker, huh? Isn't he? Makes me crazy.
Man, that is a surprisingly long 25 seconds. Yeah.
Of course,
not
he is
about
like
that.
He is like 82 or something. No offense to the 82-year-olds. Not all 82-year-olds are old talkers. Don't at me, but you know.
Maybe he was always a slow. He's just a thinker and a talker at the same time. Why? I did see a thing yesterday, taking the president to task a little bit for referring to the tariffs themselves as essentially as revenue. Discussing them as though.
Oh, my God. So what he says is billions and billions of dollars coming into this country from the Chinese. Let us be clear here. Tariffs are taxes on imported goods that are paid by the consumer. There are very few companies in this economy who are going to absorb a 25% increase in their costs and not pass that on to consumers, or even a 10% increase. So in the final analysis, tariffs are taxes paid by consumers. And that money, yes, it goes to the Treasury, but it's coming from the American consumer, not from Chinese companies.
That's what I was hoping you would say.
There
okay.
Yes. So there we go. So that's it. That's my fix. And that little bit at the end there, that's the part that drives me nuts, but whatever.
Yeah.
One can only do what one can only do.
One can only educate.
That is true. That is true. You can't make people listen. A very good friend of mine, never give advice in the expectation it's going to be taken. That's what he says. I call it the Lichman rule. All right. Enough blathering. Your turn. Here we go.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
Hi, Al Groves from Lawrenceville, Georgia.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, so some of you had some pretty strong opinions about our last episode on stock buybacks. If you remember that one, we talked to Lenore Palladino from the Roosevelt Institute. Totally fascinating conversation. David Kenney told us he didn't recall any mention in that conversation of cash dividends, that, you know, payments from companies to their shareholders, and he wants to know why. And here's what he says. I was under the impression that in the U.S. there are advantages to companies purchasing their own stock with excess cash instead of paying dividends to shareholders due to differing tax treatments of dividends versus capital gains. Is this true? Yes, there are differing tax treatments on many, many things having to do with stock and the treatment thereof. But the bigger picture and the thing we talked about was what that money is not doing to people who are not shareholders, right? I mean, shareholders would get dividends, shareholders get the benefit of the buybacks, but that wasn't the purpose of that conversation. The purpose of the conversation was, what else could this money be doing? It could be capital investment. It could be wages. It could be all kinds of different things. And that's why we didn't go there.
Got it. So dividends, sure, you could quibble about whether it should be a buyback or a dividend, but either way, it's a benefit to a shareholder and not the broader economy.
Wait. That's French for yes.
Oh.
Look, run down
you gave it more of the like wah.
Well, it's French Canadian, actually, right? I was listening to a French Canadian guy in Marketplace yesterday, and they said,
"That explains." I was like, "Really? Why'd you go with the
Yeah.
Andrew Masny left us this voice memo about what else we should have included, notwithstanding the conversation we just had in our Palladino conversation.
You did not mention the ever popular earnings per share metric. If the float is reduced, EPS goes up. So it's not just that fewer shares make each one more valuable. Fewer shares also make the company metrics look better. EPS goes up. PE, price-earning ratio, goes down. Thank you much. Love the show.
Man, a lot of jargon in there. Let me just really quickly say that the float, a stock float, is the number of shares a company has generally available for trading, which is not the total number of shares, by the way. Earnings per share, you got, and price-to-earnings ratio, that is how much it costs as compared, how much the stock costs as compared to the earnings of the company, and it's obviously a ratio. Anyway, you know, some good points in there. Yeah, there were.
Is that true? Is it true that stock buybacks make the price-to-earning ratio look better?
Yeah.
How come?
Fundamentally, because the stock buybacks affect the stock price, right? And when the stock price goes up, that ratio gets better, the ratio of price-to-earnings.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was worse. Like, if your stock price was way too high, that meant you were overvalued compared to how much you actually earn.
You know,
I thought it was the opposite.
You know what? I'm gonna fix that up, and we'll fix it on the next episode.
Okay, we'll Google it.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. We'll DuckDuckGo it.
All right. Smart. Make me smart question is where we're at. Katie Rogers tweeted us a pretty open-ended answer to the make me smart question, which, as a reminder, is what is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about. And here's what she said. I used to think we all had the same opportunity to thrive. No kidding. I was taught that. So I think we did that last week, right? Didn't we tell everybody last week? Yeah. So we went out to Katie and we said, hey, send us a voice memo with more on that. And so she did. Here you go.
Something that I thought I knew that turned out to be false is that everyone in the U.S. has an equal opportunity to thrive. I was taught that growing up. And that narrative really worked in my socioeconomic and cultural bubble. But as I got older and went away to college and traveled, I met people with different experiences and stories and opportunities. And I saw bias and confronted my own bias. And I'm now very aware that we don't actually have equal opportunity here.
Man.
It's very, as that Rebecca Traister book release gets closer and closer, not to take it back to that, but all of my women friends of a certain age and I have been having this conversation about how when you're younger, you're not that feminist. And it's only when you start to, just as one example, it's only when you start to do the sort of combined calculus of your life and look at where you are versus where you might be, or look back at moments that didn't seem that meaningful, but then in retrospect really are, that you get more aware of the bubble. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Change O gears here on the way out. Lots of ways you can get smart with us. One of them, and I'm not actually going to say this because it makes people's things go off on their kitchen counters or in their bedrooms, and I get yelled at actually on Twitter when I say this on the radio, and I'm not going to say it now. So if you've got an Amazon Echo, there's a thing you can do where you say the name of that thing, that name that I'm not going to say. You say, hey, thing. Make me smart. And then what happens is you'll hear me or Molly giving you a quick little blurb, a little thing from the day that will get you smart.
We have been explaining, for example, things like unlimited vacation time, Apple, Space Force. I did one on Space Force, which
really?
I loved.
Oh,
ATMs.
Funny.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's a lot of fun. Anyway, if you would like to get smart about a topic we have not covered, you can actually request topics with the Amazon Echo, too. When you're kind of in the skill, when you're listening to it, you're in there, then you can say, request a topic.
Oh,
and we actually, a couple of them that I recorded last week were in response to those. So it's cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
I just crank my
it's pretty neat.
Where they come from.
I have to say, Brian Ronigan did an awesome job designing the skill, like top to bottom. It's great. Love it.
And now we got to go.
And that's it. We're out.
I'm just going to let this go for now. Just a little while. All right, Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. The senior producer is Eve Troh, although she was actually in charge of this particular operation today because Shara's out. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Zatara Nieves, and by that I mean the boss of this program. And the senior vice president and general manager, the boss of it all, is Deborah Clark.
She's probably not even here. Let me just stand up. Yeah, she's not even here. There's like 1,000 producers in the control room. She's not even there.
She got squeezed out.
Whatever. You know what we're going to find out?
There
that we're
going
to
no
find
room.
Out if she listens all the way to the end. That's what we're going to find out.
Yeah, we're about to know right now.
We're about to know. Well,
when we get a dry note.
Yes. Which says,
it'll be like,
you're fine.
Oh, I listened. Way to go, nuclear.
Oh, I listened and you're fired.
And you're fired.
And you're fired. All right.
How dare you call me the boss?
That's right.